Now the general who wins a battle makes many calculations in his temple ere the battle is fought. The general who loses a battle makes but few calculations beforehand. Thus do many calculations lead to victory, and few calculations to defeat. How much more no calculation at all? It is by attention to this point that I can foresee who is likely to win or lose.
Objective Secure podcast. My name is Mike, and this is episode 3, Plots and Schemes. It's a very Zenchi time of year at the moment, so it's probably a fitting title for today's episode. And joining me today is Mr. Dan Newton. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
Good, thanks, man. Thanks for joining us on the third ever episode that I'm still working out the audio levels for.
That's okay.
So, look, as you may have noticed, fellow listeners, we're going to try and have a bunch of different people on so that we can get a very broad range of experience from the very deep pool of community members that we do have in Western Australia. Dan's relatively new to the tournament scene, and certainly to the competitive side of 40k and in the organised sense. So I think we'll probably have a quick chat with Dan now and find out a bit more about his hobby histories. And then we'll get stuck into the main topic for tonight, which is the plotting and scheming that goes into said event. So Let's kick it off, Dan. How long have you been playing?
Okay, I've been playing 40K for, I think, just on 10 years now. So I first got into it when I was around 15. It would have been just on the back of 4th edition into 5th.
So you're not really a newbie as such?
Not a newbie to the game and the background and I guess a lot more of the subtle things that we pick up as part of this awesome hobby.
So I'm assuming, like most teenage boys, somewhere around your late teens or early 20s, you probably had a hiatus?
Oh, yeah.
I think everyone goes through that. And then you're obviously back into it. So it's only been the last couple of years you've kind of entered the event scene. That's probably a fair statement?
Yeah, definitely. So probably the last 2 years. It really started coming. I did some time working in one of the Games Workshop stores. And that reconnected
Don't hold that against me. Him. He's nice.
I'm a nice person. it reconnected me with some of the people who were actually involved in the competitive scene. And that allowed me a way to just reintegrate myself back into that.
So when would that would have been sort of the early 2010, 2011, 2012, or was it a bit later than that?
Probably 2012 to 2013.
So for those of you WA listeners here, you'll remember that was probably towards the last couple of Ultimates. We still had a relatively stable, we were probably getting, 4 events a year, maybe 5 events a year across the calendar. But we were certainly slowing down in terms of organised play. There were really only one or two people doing the event organisation at that point in time. And as an organiser myself and having seen it firsthand over the years and feeling it myself, you do get burnt out if you run too many too quickly. So it doesn't surprise me that people do step away from it. So you obviously came in at the tail end of some of that, and obviously 2014 was a fairly barren year in terms of events, and even 2015 for that matter. I think we only had 2 in 2015 until Masters. I think it was that many. And then you did come along to Masters in November, almost 12 months ago. Actually, it was just over 12 months ago. We had our little 1 year Masters party here at my house a couple of days ago on my birthday. So that was the first time I think we'd really interacted at an organised event, yeah. Albeit with me being the organiser, with your Lamenters, aren't they?
The White Angel Successes. Lamenters, yep. So everyone keeps telling me they've been written out of fiction, but I'm holding on to my one page that they're in the 4th edition Blood Rangers rulebook.
Well, they're in, we were talking about this earlier before we started recording, they were in the Babab Wars book, is that right?
Yes. From Forge World? Yeah, so they started with Lufthoron and his Astral Claws, as part of the secessionists.
Oh, they were the bad guys.
They were the bad guys, yeah. They were just misunderstood.
So what you're telling me is you really need to paint a Chaos Army.
Yeah,
put it out your system.
I really should paint the Chaos Army I own and build that. Maybe another one.
Well, we've got Zench coming out this month, so it's a great time to do it.
Yes, it's very true.
And who doesn't like Magnus the Red?
Oh, he's amazing. He's so big.
Yeah. Oh, look, it's an interesting time to be in 40K and certainly into the competitive scene. I mean, and I use the word competitive, and it's probably not a fair statement for what we actually have in Perth. We really have a fairly wide range of events that populate our calendar. And that's not just because of what I run, it's because of what the clubs around us run as well. And they do a really great job of filling in some of the gaps. And that's important because, you know, we need to have variety. It's the one thing that I always felt was lacking from those 2010 through 2014 period was everyone was running the same event. It was 1850 or 2000 or 1500, and it was the same missions and it was the same thing over and over and over again. And how you prepare for those competitive events is very different to how you prepare for a hobby event. And that's why the calendar is quite broad in that sense. So you've obviously been, so you did 5 of our events this year, is that right?
Yeah, did 5 of the events out of the, I think, 8 we...
Yeah, it was 8 on the calendar.
8 on the calendar.
One of them was Age of Sigmar, which I don't believe you play at the moment to a significant degree.
Nah, not at the moment. I've got my older Warhammer Fantasy army, which is about a 4,000-point orc force. I have started a Zench force for Age of Sigmar, but that's developing at the moment.
Yeah.
But I took a lot of photos.
Well, yeah, you did come along to that, so I suppose that technically qualifies. And then you missed... it was Heresy. It must have been Heresy.
I missed Western Fringe and I missed Linebreaker.
Yes, the trip down to Albany for the long week, or it wasn't a long weekend back then. It will be next year. Or,
yeah.
Is it next year? Yes, yeah,
next year. Next year. Still next year.
I'm planning 2017, so I keep saying next. I keep saying next year, but I also keep saying this year because, or it's I said the... last year because the events are already run. It's doing my head in these last few days. So so we did 5 events with you last. See, there we go. It's not last year. It's this year. So we did First Blood.
Yes.
Which was our intro event, 750 points and
yep.
Reasonably lightweight style armies.
Very, very lightweight. You had that one guy that bought a Storm Raven who lost in 15 minutes.
Yeah, that was all kinds of awesome. Yes, Dan failed a reserve roll and his entire army didn't rock up and that was game over.
Fraser, kudos to you for rolling those dice that killed the 5 dudes.
So we had that, which was probably the shortest game in OBSEC's history for an organized event at least. Then we had...
Slay the Warlord.
Yeah, Slay the Warlord. That was 1250, and that was very much a Hero Hammer style event. The goal there was to bring characters to punch each other to death with.
Yep.
That was held at one of the local Games Workshop stores who hosted us for the event. And that event will be moved to show for 2017.
Oh, sweet.
So we've got a bit more room rather than the very small space we had at the store. and that'll also allow us to indulge in a bit of that sort of Hero Hammer in a fun way at that sort of... It's the right event to run that particular tournament, I feel.
Yeah.
And then we had WATC,
yep.
Which was the West Australian Team Challenge, which is modelled off of the ETC, the European Team Challenge, and then obviously ATC, the Australian Team Challenge as well. Just localised to Perth, where you captained a team.
I did captain a team, yeah. And so again, taking the Lamenters, I flew 3 Storm Ravens, because, hey, they're cool.
Actually, you've had a theme. I don't think I've seen a list without at least one in it this year.
Yeah. Yeah, I started a trend that was sort of already there, but...
yeah, but you notice how no one's kept up with that trend except you.
I know, I'm the only one. It's working for me, though.
Well, your results have improved as the year's gone on.
Significantly. We'll get into that later.
Yes. And then we did the mixed doubles, which was designed to bring your lovely wife along for the ride.
Yes.
It looked like you guys had a good time.
Yeah. First of all, yes, she's real. and so she plays a Space Wolf faction, so we actually
she won a couple of the games for you because you were getting trashed.
I was not holding my weight in those events. No. But yeah, we both had an absolute ball with that, and it was a real jumping point for her to consider whether she wanted to get more involved in 40K.
Yeah, and from what I understand, she's coming to First Blood next year as a standalone participant, isn't she?
Yes, she's left me behind.
So that's kind of awesome. I would dearly love to see her finish the rankings higher. That would be the ultimate thing.
It'd be more embarrassing if she faces me in a game, smashes me, and then places higher.
That all works well. And then, obviously, it culminated in September with the second annual Masters event.
Yes.
Where, I'm trying to remember now. You didn't get sportsmanship. You didn't get sports
no,
this year.
No, no. I lost out sports, but that's because I
you won
changed
more.
The list. Yeah, changed the list and the reason I went. So I traded sportsmanship for 13th place. So I was okay with that.
Now that should be clarified. That's 13 out of how many did we have? We had just under 60 participants.
Yeah, just under
60. So 13th out of 60 is a very respectable finish for any event, particularly with six games over 2 days, 2,000 points. And largely unrestricted. There were a couple of little changes, but for the most part, it was for 40K. I mean, we changed invisibility, which is a pretty common one in ITC's format, to Weapon Skill Ballistic Skill 1. And we had a vague limit on super heavies, but nothing untoward that meant you couldn't take them.
No.
So it was good to see, particularly the growth of you over the last 12 months in terms of your performances at these events. And certainly, it shows that by playing at multiple events and learning one army, and that's, I suppose, the biggest thing that we'll talk about in a second, that you really can become very proficient at that army despite some of the list's innate built-in flaws. So that's been really nice to see. And you're not the only one who's had that. I mean, we've seen Russell Moore with his orcs show up at quite a few, and he's certainly surprised everyone at Masters where he was smashing face for the first few rounds.
Yeah, he did.
And there's been a couple of other guys who've really stepped up and really showed what happens when you play one army consistently over a period, as opposed to taking the latest shiny thing and then changing every other month.
Yeah, I think we're at a really good point. I mean, again, I am a newcomer, but a lot of people have been willing to stick with their own armies and really push the boundaries of what they can do with that army. I know one opponent who I've played a couple of times now, Brad Nielsen, he's had a very similar list for his demons for quite a while.
Well, those demons have been around, in my experience at least, for at least since 20, it was 2004, give or take.
Yeah, wow.
I think it was the first version, the World Eaters component of it at least.
Yep.
So he's been around on and off. He had a break in the middle there because he travelled and did a whole bunch of stuff overseas. But those demons are now pretty consistent. They're actually coming with him to Vegas with me in February, which will be really cool.
Excellent.
I need to talk to him about the new Zench supplement, particularly the new Pink, Blue and Brimstone Horrors, which, if rumours be true, are just bonkers. So
I think you mean cool, Mike.
Well, they'd be cool if I was taking them, but at the moment they're bonkers because I have to try and kill them. So, it's players like that who, you know, he's gotten better and better and better with them.
Yeah.
And those results speak for themselves because he is a lovely painter, he's a lovely guy to play, and he's slowly creeping up the ranks as he wins more and more games with them, and it's great to see.
Yeah.
But we can talk a lot more about prep for events in just a moment. Apart from prep, my prep, I need to really practice what we talk about tonight because that didn't happen for this last event. If anyone's been reading the OBSEC website, you'll have seen my little four-part Corsair series and realised that I was stupid enough to decide to learn airbrushing 6 hours before I was due to be in an event with an army that was unpainted. And that's not something I can recommend for anyone who wants to stay sane and actually get any sleep. And to win it, that was a nice little consolation prize for the pain and aggravation in the preceding 48 hours to get the army on the table. But I'll talk about that, I suppose, as we talk about the prep in just a second. So we're going to take a quick break, grab a drink, and we'll be back to talk about tournament planning and prep. So we're back with our main topic tonight, which is the plotting and scheming in the title of today's episode, which is the plotting and scheming that goes into getting ready for an event. Now, Dan's had a lot of experience over the last 12 months with a lot of the key factors that go into preparing and planning an event and the success of those events. And I've got a few years of failing to plan under my belt. So we're going to cover some of the basics. We're not going to cover all of it because it's a massive topic. We probably will end up turning this into some sort of series, but we're going to start tonight by discussing primarily the players pack and establishing what the tournament is and understanding what should be in a good players pack so that you as a player can understand what you should be expecting, and then obviously so you can set some goals and expectations for yourself. So I like to think my players' packs are whiz-bang and whatnot, but I still get caught out with stuff that I forget to put in them. They're getting better, but they're also getting longer. I don't know if you've noticed.
They are getting longer.
So when you first got a players' pack, For Masters in 2015, that was 9 pages, I think, plus the missions.
Yes.
8 or 9 pages. As a new player, how did you find that?
I guess because of my personality, I actually really enjoyed having that. I know that sounds really weird, but it gave me an idea of what to be looking for. It also let me know what sort of event I was coming to. It has all the information that I was actually needing, which allowed me to create an army and go have some fun.
Look, and just to clarify that for Dan, this isn't about me sitting there and crowing about how awesome I am. It's a genuine thing that as a player and a player for 15 years now at organized events, I've been to events where the player's pack is a Facebook post, and I've been to the opposite end of that spectrum where you get a 20-page document that is very, very detailed and defined, and obviously any TO has to spend their own time and find that happy medium to give the players the information they need. And I suppose TO should be a catch-all term for any event organizer because it doesn't have to be a tournament organizer. Any TO or EO, I think EO just sounds like it belongs in part of a song, you know, BINGO. Any event organizer or tournament organizer really needs to set that standard for their players so that there's an expectation that the players can have and that those expectations are then met. So by this, I mean when we did the Masters Players Pack, essentially the soft scores were all but non-existent. It was very much aimed as a competitive 40K event.
You brought your A game, that was it.
Yeah, you got a few nominal points for sportsmanship, which were actually hard to get, and they still remain hard to get because of the way we structure it. But it meant that those players were rewarding players who did the right thing and not necessarily penalising people for having personality clashes. And then the painting side of it was purely player driven in terms of judging for the best painted for the day. So really your points came from winning games. Now you flip that on its head to something like First Blood for next year or even this year's one. The scoring for 2017's First Blood is 80 points for generalship and 70 for painting and sports.
Yeah, it's a much heavier weighting.
And that's hopefully screams to players that it's a hobby event rather than a come and punch your best friend in the face event.
Yeah, you can still do that if you want, but
That might not be your best
you may
friend
not be your best
afterwards.
friend. Yeah, you might lose more friends than make them.
So yeah, the goal is, I suppose, as a player, the first port of call for me at least is to, ignoring the restrictions and all the rest of it, what is the event? Is it a hobby event? Is it a hardcore tournament? Is it something in between? And then I suppose once you've figured that out, for me, I always like to have a goal going into these events. What are you aiming to achieve? And I hear a lot of people go, "Oh, I just go along for the fun of it." Well, that's your goal then. Saying you've got a goal for an event doesn't make you a bad person, doesn't make you a win at all costs jerk. It means that you're setting your own expectations as I'm going along to play 4 to 6 games with a bunch of people I probably don't know and probably a bunch of people I do, against new armies, against new faces, have a laugh, and I don't really mind what the outcome is.
So I guess a good example of that is in 2015 at the Masters event, I went to have fun and make sure all of my opponents had fun. And they obviously did, they voted me best sport, but it was a lot easier with that in mind as my goal.
I suppose, just psychologically speaking, if you go along with a mindset of, "Oh my God, I'm going to come along, I want to win this, I have to win this," you're putting a lot of arbitrary pressure on yourself straight away. It's an easy one to fall into a trap of because if you go along with that mindset and then drop a game, then all of a sudden you're going to have a bad rest of the day because you've psychologically defeated yourself before you even started. And I think if you're realistic about it, you should be able to go into an event and go, "Okay, I would really love to win this event." There's nothing wrong with winning. I want to say that as well. There is absolutely nothing wrong with wanting to win games and wanting to win the event. It's how you go about doing that that has an impact. So having the goal of "I want to win the event" is 100% fine, and it's something that I've, very rarely done for myself. And it's something that, if I want to take it seriously, then that's the goal I'll set. But that doesn't mean I have to go along and be a jerk doing it. So once you've set your goal and you've had a look at how to achieve that goal, I suppose is the next part, which is where, again, the players pack comes in. So we talked about the hobby event versus tournament event. And that, I mean, I had this happen on the weekend just gone with my Corsairs. We had a very, very, very concise players pack. They gave us the scoring sheets for painting and where we'd get our extra points for sports. Oh, there was no sports, sorry. Hobby stuff, so like boards and stories and stuff. So
tokens, markers.
So it wasn't all generalship. but it was probably 70-30 generalship. Like, okay. Generalship was out of 80, painting was out of, I think it was out of 40, so 120. So yeah, it's 65-35, something like that.
Yeah.
And for me, I went, okay, what's my goal? My goal was actually to go and get practice games for LVO. So for me, the interest was more in understanding how the units worked. Who I played wasn't necessarily relevant to that. It was about getting in complex games against good opponents to learn more about the army, which actually worked out pretty well because I learned a lot and won the event. But what I did do, though, with the scoring suite, there's obviously very little you can do for the generalship side of things until you get there on the day, other than list building and planning for the missions.
Yeah.
But with the painting score sheet, if you've got it, it's a really easy one to find some cheat points to put into an overall score if that's your goal.
Absolutely.
For a lot of the Masters stuff that we've done, and we've got an even more expansive one for First Blood, which you probably saw if you downloaded the Players Pack already, it's a very easy one to go through and tick some boxes and get yourself some extra points that you might otherwise not get simply by adding a few tufts of grass to a base to add some extra texture, or naming your units on your story that goes with them beside the army.
Yeah, just a quick point on that. Naming your units and writing background for your army is fun. I don't care who you are, it's fun. And it gets you extra points in most events.
And you don't have to be a novelist. Like, you don't have to be Dan Abnett to write a little, like, three-paragraph thing about who your leader is and what he's punched in the face recently. And then on the army list, instead of just having Space Marine Captain with Thunderhammer, Storm Shield, Space Marine Bike, Artificer Armor, blah, 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 naming him Space Marine Captain, or maybe not Smash Face, but giving him a suitably 40k name is often a really easy way for a lot of these hobby-based events to grab points here and there if, you know, if you're really keen on making sure you get the best possible result you can.
Yeah, I've already got First Blood 2017's painting checklist on my painting station, and there's, I think, a quick 4 or 5 points I can grab just by making small changes to my existing army.
And look, I'll be honest, that painting card, if you look at it, is actually a little bit more harsh in places than the 2016 one.
Yeah, I'm talking about the basic points here.
But it is one that a lot of the time you can look at your army and go, okay, cool. Oh, I never really got around to putting that unit marking on my tactical squad. If I go and paint the number one on all their shoulder pads, or get the transfers out and drop a transfer on their knees or on their shoulder pads, oh, look, all my models have got unit markings. That's an extra point.
Yeah.
And that can be stuff that lets you finish armies that you've been working on for 12 months, and it gives you that inspiration to kind of go back to them and finish them off.
Yeah.
So it's good for your own hobby, but it's also good for your event result, and then it's obviously done for the next time round.
Yes.
So it's a constant evolution. Your Lamenters, I remember the first time I saw them, some of them had checks and some of them didn't. And then over the year, we've slowly seen more and more checks, to the point the drop pods all had checks on them.
Yes.
And then you pop the doors and you can't see the damn things.
I know.
Which is just utterly hilarious when you see them. We'll have to get some photos of your army to go with this episode now I think of it. So those sorts of things, particularly in the painting side of things, can be really easy points if they are added to your overall score for you to just sneak through and pick up. I made my Corsairs, the 3-colour minimum was the first goal. Then it was, okay, where are the extra points? Oh, you know, shading and highlighting, adding some freehand extra details. I made sure that I ticked as many boxes as I could in the time frame I had, and ended up, I think, 30 points for painting. Now, and by my own admission to the TO, the army wasn't finished by my standards. And I still ended up, I think, 6th out of 24 for painting, which was just magic. It actually made me kick myself a little bit, thinking, God damn it, I could have painted, like, if I'd
gone a little bit more.
If Forge would have delivered it earlier, it would have been fine.
Well, this is true.
So, it doesn't matter, though. It's done now. So, once you've looked at your soft scores, obviously your sportsmanship side of things, and there's not so much we can say to that, because each person's personality is obviously going to have a severe impact on how you're perceived in terms of sportsmanship.
Yeah.
And how your opponent's personality clashes with your own as well, and we've seen that at events. I don't think there's ever been an event I've been to that there haven't been two heads that kind of butted a little bit, and you had those conflicts. It's how you resolve those conflicts that can really make or break your sportsmanship score, if there is one.
Absolutely.
I think being polite and courteous is basic human sort of behavior, in my opinion, and if you maintain that in a professional sense, and it sounds stupid saying professional with war dollies, I know, but if you treat it professionally, if you have a clashing of personalities and a clashing of ideologies across the table, and it does happen, as long as you stay polite and as if you were dealing with a work associate in some way professional.
Yep.
You shouldn't be utterly pinged or slammed for your sports score simply for being a clash of personalities.
Yeah. At the end of the day, if you do have a disagreement and you can't resolve it, you agree to disagree and you move on. You don't have to linger on it.
No. And getting the TO involved in those cases is also not a bad idea if there is an agree to disagree moment, because it does happen. And there's no shame and there should be no penalty for you calling a TO over and saying, hey, look, he thinks X, I think Y, and sharing those two viewpoints and letting the TO make that call.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's part of the process. I mean, we all play games against our mates and there are all these sort of micro silos around. And as soon as you start breaking those silos down and playing against different people, people will read things differently. I mean, look at the rigmarole with the infiltrate special rule and the FAQ that's gone with it, and it's still not right.
Yeah, it still doesn't.
I mean, Tank Shock, have you read the new Tank Shock FAQ? My God.
Yeah.
It's just as bad. It's actually worse.
It doesn't actually help.
Well, I was reading a forum earlier today, and there's already two versions. Like, I've gotten on and gone, well, that's not the way I read it. This is how I read it. And they go, no, you're not reading it. I'm reading it this way. And you go, this is an FAQ from a rule, like for a rule book, and it's still not
clear,
because you've got regional discrepancies, you've got language discrepancies, you've just got reading comprehension discrepancies. So
it's something which, to a certain extent, there are some things that it's always going to be a little bit of give and take. Like in my gaming group, we've got certain house rules that play a certain way. That means I can't use those if I'm playing in a tournament. As long as I'm aware of that, it's not really a problem, but I won't necessarily be used to playing it that way.
I think a lot of the time, though, you can get on the front foot with some of those house rule things where you do find a grey area in the rules, and it's amazing how often they happen, particularly when you've got 20-some armies with a lot of codex variations and all the supplements that go under them.
Yeah.
If you do have a house rule on how to resolve something in your army, and there is no FAQ, and there is no TO FAQ, and there is no official ruling for it, there's nothing wrong with getting to the table with your opponent going, hey, look, this has happened a couple of times in my gaming group with this particular unit in this instance.
Yeah.
It may not happen in your game, but there's no harm in bringing that to your opponent's attention and going, hey, it actually matters how this is resolved.
Yeah.
This is, as my gaming group, this is how we resolved it. Are you okay with that, yes or no? And they might either say, yep, I don't care. And to be honest, I find that's probably the most common result. Yep. But there will be some people who might have played that army, or their mates play that army, or someone will go, oh, well, we resolved it this way. And at that point, you can get it out so that you both have the same expectation for the game.
Correct.
So the last part, obviously, with preparing your goal, I suppose, is the generalship side of things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned earlier that 2015's Masters was more about going along, having fun, meeting the community and playing some fun games and then making sure everyone enjoyed them.
Mm.
What about 2016?
2016 was quite different. I decided I want to, how am I going to put this, beat face. I took a list that was, I may as well just quickly run through it. It was the Angel's Fury Spearhead, 3 Storm Ravens, 30 Tactical Marines, with teleport homers and drop down deep striking stuff. But I actually didn't use any deep striking stuff. Instead, I put 2 Razorbacks on the table with combat squads, 2 Librarians level 2 using Technomancy, and an Imperial Knight. And so my 2 Librarians played the role of Tech Marine, making my Storm Ravens Ballistic Skill 5, giving it Will Not Die, or making them armor 13.
Armor 13 was brutal.
Most people went, what do you mean your armor 13 immune to melter? Sorry. There's a fair bit of disgruntlement when I was using Death from the Skies formations in addition to all that.
Even the knight could have been buffed quite nicely with a couple of those powers.
In one of the games, my librarian came out and buffed the knight to armor 14 on the front, and then I charged somebody.
So without meltables or a chain fist, you're out of luck.
Yeah, that was fun.
So obviously that thought process in going and putting that army together was a very different one based on what your goal was and obviously what the players pack was.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I took a much more of a, I wanted to present a much harder and more competitive, arguably more competitive list than what I'd taken the previous year, which was mechanized infantry. And so I worked on the principle of putting multiple hard hitting targets on the table, being 3 Ravens and an Imperial Knight. And it actually worked in my favor. A lot of the armies that I came up against looked at my army and went, how the heck am I going to kill all four of those units. The Razorbacks were never an issue. Even the Librarians were never an issue, but it was dealing with three Flyers and an Imperial Knight was quite challenging.
You played one of the Horton brothers, didn't you, with his... It was Andrew, wasn't it?
It was Andrew, yep.
With it was four or five Soul Grinders, Knight.
He took three Gorkonauts, a Renegade Knight, and I think...
Was it four?
I think three Soul Grinders.
I don't remember. It was three or four.
Three or four. So he had like eight models in his army for 2,000 points, which was a bit of a rort anyway.
And it was all walkers.
It was all walkers. So, you know. So I taught him what it's like to feel like immobilized on his back edge. And four of his walkers never made it more than 6 inches out of his deployment zone. The first turn, I was like, right, we'll go easy. We'll pick on this Soul Grinder over here. Long range melter shot. Six to hit, six to pen, six to blow up. Failed his demon save. I was like, well, that's first blood and a kill point, and I'm already on the way. And he just went, you only have to kill one more turn and you're done.
But it's interesting, though, that, like you say, when building that army, you looked at the scoring and went, okay, how do I maximize my own score while minimizing what I'm giving up? Now, three Storm Ravens, it's actually very similar to... there were just still GTs held here by Games Workshop back in the early 2000s. I took a 2,000-point Grey Knight army in 2004 to the GT. And what was really interesting about that was I took three Land Raiders. Now, this is just tipping into 4th edition at this point.
Yep.
And it was the first 4th edition tournament, but it was using the 3rd edition Demon Hunter book. So my army was two Land Raiders, a Crusader, 8 Terminators, 2 units of 10... Strike Knights, what they are now, and 5 deep striking guys. That was it. Like, that was the army. And the amount of people that just looked at the army, because 3rd edition was definitely the edition of Plasma.
Yeah.
And I put 3 armor 14 hulls on the table, and the amount of people that looked at it and went, oh, crap.
I can't deal with armor 14.
One of my fondest memories of that is I played a Dark Elder player, Brad, his name was. I haven't seen him around in a few years now, but he had Dark Elder. And he'd won all of his games like I had up until round 6. And I still remember there, and people are going to me, oh my God, man, he's got Dark Lances. He's got 7 Dark Lances. And I still remember in my naivety going, oh my God, Dark Lances, they're just my armor to 12. Oh no, without actually thinking that, hang on a minute, they still have to pen, then they still have to do damage, and the chances of blowing up a Land Raider in 3rd edition
minuscule.
Was so small that I went, at the time, I was so panicked, I went, right, Dead Ravager, Dark Lances, and literally killed every Dark Lance in the army on turn 1, and then nearly lost the game because all these witches and shit assaulted me without me thinking about it. So, but, you know, taking something like that when you are going competitive, particularly if you know your player base, is a really viable tactic when list building, particularly if you know what the missions are.
Yeah.
And the missions are just as vital to that process as anything else, because... if you know that, you know, your missions are worth 80% of your points and you've got the missions on hand, you can prep on how to deal with those missions.
Yes.
And, I mean, we run fairly complex ones for Masters where you play Eternal War, you play Maelstrom, and you play Kill Points all at the same time.
It's amazing.
To be honest, in my personal experience and preferences, I don't see why you shouldn't just run that all the time, because you can vary that combination 6 or 7 different ways per mission, because obviously you can run Maelstrom 1 with missions 1 to 5,
yep,
for Eternal War, and then you can run Maelstrom 2 with missions 1 to 5, and vary them up, which is great, but it does help build some fairly balanced armies to make sure you're scoring points.
Yeah. One of the best things that I've probably noticed in playing Masters in that particular format with the missions, your considerably more powerful lists are curbed a little bit, because there are other ways to get points.
Yeah.
And so any army, regardless of the list building itself, any army has the potential to score points.
Yeah. And that's certainly, I mean, if you think about, if you're scoring Maelstrom cards every turn and you're only scoring Maelstrom cards every turn, it really does favor the multiple small units,
yep,
that are very mobile. Things, yes, like Dark Elder Skimmers, Eldar Jet Bikes,
Blood Angels, fast tanks.
Yep. Even Tau with their jump, shoot, jump.
Yeah.
Can be very, very mobile. Anything that deep strikes and can re-deep strike using ongoing reserves, anything like that can help you score Maelstrom cards quickly and efficiently across the table.
Yep.
The flip side of that is those armies don't have a lot of staying power late game because they are multiple small units.
Yeah.
So if you're playing an Eternal War mission where you want to hold an objective at the end of the game, the MSU builds don't necessarily work as well.
Nah, you end up, because in 2015 Masters, I ran MSU, mechanized Blood Angels, and I most of the time was putting two smaller mechanized units onto one objective in order to maintain control of it.
Yeah.
Because one would just get vaped. I mean, it's five Marines.
And I also think the Eternal War, generally speaking, the Eternal War missions tend to favor a Death Star build.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you can deploy those objectives fairly close together and threaten three of the five objectives with a Death Star of 1,000, 1,500 points, more depending on the armies and the combos, then it can be very hard for an MSU army to really counter that.
Yeah.
Darting in and out and sacrificing a 100-point unit from Maelstrom Card is fine, but trying to pick apart a 1,500-point Thunderwolf Star with a Liberius Conclave is a big ask for any army, let alone trying to do it with 60-point Guardians or Dark Elder Warriors.
Yeah, statistically it can be done, but I don't favour your odds.
40K is all about understanding your odds and where you can and can't play them, and those are odds that you just don't like.
Yeah.
The third part of it is also kill points, which helps mitigate the MSU spam and the ability to claim so many cards so quickly, as you do give up kill points every turn.
You have to play smart.
Yeah, so I really do like that combination. I first got exposed to it at ETC. It's the format they run. We've run it at the last three ATCs I've been to, it's been run that way. I've now run two Masters and multiple events across the 2016 calendar with that format. And unless I get to Vegas and play the LVO missions, and we're going to start practicing for that this week, hopefully, or maybe next. Unless I get to LVO and go, oh my God, these are the best missions since sliced bread, I can't actually see myself changing that format particularly. From First Blood, we're not running Eternal War. We're only running Maelstrom. And the decision behind that is, again, driven by the player's pack. Because we're only playing 1,000-point games. You can't take formations. You're limited in Force Org chart. Holding objectives at the end of that game is going to be tantamount to impossible.
Yeah. And I guess the one thing that pulling up about the First Blood and the missions there is it, again, really encourages that hobby element of the tournament where it's, your soft scores count for more. And the missions is going to be where you can put those Maelstrom cards.
Yeah, exactly. So I think once you understand how you score points at an event, and I say event because we ran Western Fringe, which was much closer to a hobby event than anything we'd ever done before, where it was literally a win-loss draw was the score. I think once you understand how you score your points, then you can obviously take the next step, which is what I'm going to take. And obviously start doing some of that prep work and planning. So once you understand the missions and know where you want to score and what your goal is, then you can actually start doing the work that you need to get ready.
Yeah, you can start that next step.
And a lot of the time that can be as easy as, right, I'm going to go and do some painting. And that's a good thing to hear any hobbyist say. And some people love it and some people hate it. Yeah. It's a fact of life for a lot of tournaments that they expect three colours.
Yeah.
And certainly, depending on the TO, I've seen tournaments where if it's not three colours, take it off.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen others where I had one actually happen this year where a guy got in touch with me, was painting his army the night before, the airbrush broke, sent me a bunch of photos where half of it's painted and half of it's not, and he's got 8 hours, 10 hours before the event, and he's gone, oh, shall I just not bother turning up? No, of course not. You've done the right thing, you've gotten in touch with the TO. I explained to him that obviously that's going to affect his painting score. It's not,
Yeah,
he's left it till the last minute. But at the same time, I don't like seeing players miss out because they feel like they can't attend because of that. And, we're fairly lenient in that whole three-colour thing these days. It's about encouraging players to get better for each event. And your army is a great example of that.
Yeah.
Because there were, was it Assault Marines I remember seeing, which were basically yellow with black weapons
and red eyes. It was bad.
And don't look too closely at the yellow.
Yeah, I was like, that yellow, let's just not talk about how badly that's applied.
It's an Avalon Sunset, isn't it?
Yeah, which conveniently they are now bringing out in an aerosol can, so I'll be able to make more use of
and tidy up some, of, tidy the up some units. Of
all that. my first... I guess my painting experience with the tournaments has normally been, okay, I've got a lot of grey marines that need to become three colours.
Yeah.
And I need to get that done across, 2,000 points. Awesome.
Yeah.
do the right thing, try and schedule out your time, give yourself achievable goals, and just
Don't do the night before thing.
I've
done it so many times, and every time I do it, I say it's going to be the last, and I still, like, I've got 8 weeks to LVO.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you I'm painting the day before I fly out.
Yeah, you probably will. If it's just on a couple of models that aren't quite done.
I really don't want to be, but I can just see the writing on the wall already, particularly since I'm thinking about changing the list, which means ordering for Forge World, which means
waiting. That does not help.
No. So, look, I suppose the key thing I want you to take away, because we're not going to get too strung out into some of this, because we could literally chat about this for hours. I mean, I wrote a 40-page book on this.
Which is awesome. You should get it.
There's a link on the website if you want to go digging for it. It's... I think it's $5 to download.
Yep.
And that's purely to cover my hosting costs and everything like that. But it's 15 years of my experience, and hopefully it's of some use to anyone listening to this.
I think you'd struggle not to get anything out of it.
We've got some worksheets in there if you really want to test yourself and try and schedule stuff depending on what type of hobbyist you are. And it does go into a lot of the stuff we talked about tonight and then some. And like I say, I might have Dan back in the future to do a follow-up episode to this, and we'll go through some more of that. But I suppose what I'm hoping you can take away from this is grab the player's pack, understand what you can and can't achieve, and set a realistic goal.
Yeah.
And once you've got that goal in place, it's very easy then to set yourself up to achieve that goal and leave the tournament with a sense of satisfaction, as opposed to a bitter taste in your mouth because you expected X and got Y. If you go along to a hardcore tournament event with your favorite hobby unit of Vespids alongside your ethereal with Tau Crisis suits running burst cannons and, you know, Riptides with burst cannons and then drop in railgun toting hammerheads and more Vespid.
And then you realize that invisibility is a thing.
Yeah, and that you have no Markolites. If you take along your hobby event style armies to a tournament, you have to be prepared for the fact that the other people are coming along with tournament lists. And as long as you understand that and can expect that, you won't walk out of that tournament going, well, that was terrible because I got my face smashed in 6 games in a row. And that's, I suppose, the biggest takeaway for me for any event. If you set your expectations, set your goal, make it realistic, there's nothing wrong with saying that realistically you want to win, because if you think you can do that, there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely.
But don't go into a hobby event with a hardcore smash face tournament list and then wonder why you didn't win, and vice versa.
Yeah. Don't bring a knife to a gunfight and then complain about it.
Yeah. Or, you know, a knife to a sword fight or...
Yeah. Or a pistol to a rocket launcher range.
Yeah. After the war punters, yeah.
It's, yeah. Yeah.
I'm gonna bring a pistol to my temporal distortion terrain space.
What does that do, Mike?
Anyone who hasn't seen War Punters in action, I thought Forge World were getting better. And then I put two of these on the table and I actually felt guilty most of the weekend shooting them. There was a lot of glee, but there was guilt as well.
Mixed feelings.
But that's getting a bit off topic. So yeah, look, set a goal, make it realistic, make it achievable.
Yeah.
What's the SMART is the common one used in business. Specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time sensitive, or time managed, or whatever, however you want to pronounce the T. So, specific goal, I want to place top 10 at this next coming event. Measurable, well, that's really easy because I can measure the success of the event post-event. Achievable, well, everything should be achievable as long as you are realistic with your own skills.
Yep.
Which comes onto realistic.
Yes.
Is it realistically achievable? Oh, it's 3 days till the tournament. My army's bare plastic. Oh, look, if you've got 3 days off and you don't need to sleep, maybe. And time sensitive is another one. If you've got 8 weeks out like I do from LVO, can I get another... Well, I don't even need to get it all painted now. Most of it's painted.
No, you only need to get a portion done.
You know, I've probably got 500 or 600 points to paint. Is that realistic? Absolutely. Is it going to get done tomorrow? No.
Yeah, is it timely?
And then once you've got that goal, stick to it. Build a list that supports it.
Yep.
Paint it to the guidelines that you've got. Take some planning. We'll talk about missions in the next episode, I think, because there's plenty of ways that you can plan for missions with armies, depending on what you build. I made the mistake of having a conversation with someone relatively new to the tournament scene and just rambled on at him for 40 minutes. And at the end, he looked at me and went, oh my God, how did you think of all that? And I went, I need to talk about this on an episode.
Yep. So
that might have to be the next one. But look, we'll call it there. Hopefully you've got something out of our anecdotal evidence and ramblings. And we'll be back to wrap up the episode in just a sec. That's it for tonight's episode. I hope you've enjoyed yourself. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Dan.
That's all right. Thanks for having me.
I'm sure that you'll be back again to talk more about this because off air, I often find with these sorts of recordings, particularly in the past with Worlds on Radio and with this one for the couple of guests we have had, you turn the microphone off and go, God damn, I wish I'd left it recording.
Yeah.
Because you often get some really good tidbits just from casual conversation. Unfortunately, a lot of it isn't broadcastable if you want to keep the PG rating. So we do try and keep it clean for any of our listeners, and particularly for the younger guys. It's something that we've always tried to do with World Zone Radio with Luke, and then obviously going forward, I'd like to try and maintain that polite audio to listen to with friends and family or young children about, so that you don't feel guilty about someone swearing all the time. But look, hopefully you've enjoyed listening to us ramble about preparing for tournaments. Speaking of that, what have you got up next, Dan?
So definitely for me, continue the preparation and scheming for First Blood.
You're saying you've got Lord of the Rings coming up as well.
I do have Lord of the Rings coming up, and I'm playing Mordor, so there's probably...
So what's the Mordor list?
So the Mordor list is a Ringwraith, who's going to be the Dark Marshal.
Yep.
A troll, who's a chieftain, who leads a warband of 12 orcs. A shaman. It's then a Morannon orc chieftain, who has 12 Morannon orcs following him.
Stay with us, folks, because I didn't understand what that was either. I heard orc. I don't know what the rest of it is.
So you basically have your characters or your leaders have 12 warriors that follow them.
So this is using the War of the Ring format, isn't it?
Yeah.
So these are sort of skirmish units.
Skirmish-style units that the units still act independently on the battlefield, but each warband has to be allocated to a hero.
Okay, yeah.
I'm actually running... It's an 800-point force. And from where it was up to... So done the troll, done the shaman, done the Morannon orc. Oh, and following the Ringwraith is a unit of 6 Morgul knights.
Oh, they were horrible in the original Lord of the Rings game.
I think you mean amazing.
Oh, look, I always liked the Uruk-hai, so
yeah.
I'm still on that bad guy side, but I always liked the Uruk-hai just because I like the idea of big berserker orcs with giant stabby things.
Massive stabby swords and pikes that 3 ranks deep. It's silly.
So you've got that in a couple of weeks' time?
Two weeks. 2 weeks on Sunday, I believe.
And then anything before Christmas, or is that the last thing?
From tournament wise, that's the last thing. Got a social gaming night that I'm planning on attending in 2 days.
Hours. Yeah. Hopefully this episode will be out before then.
Yes.
That might be tomorrow's job for the editing. And then we hit January again.
Yep. And that'll very much be finishing up prep for First Blood, playing lots of games with 1,000 points, getting my Mephiston painted up all nice.
And hopefully me squeezing you for an 1850 LVO practice game with my abusive Corsairs to try and get some practice in.
Which I'll take on the chin with a smile. And then rant to Ali at home.
It won't be that bad. Although I have made an agreement with Rod. Because of the weekend with the games that I played, pretty much every time I went first, I killed 700 or 800 points worth of the opponent, and that was almost the game, turn one. Those Warp Hunters are just utterly horrific. Now, I have no idea whether that's good or bad in the concept of LVO.
Yeah.
I just know that at 1650, those two Warp Hunters were just bonkers. Brutal. Utterly bonkers. So he has made me promise that every practice game that I play from here on out, I guarantee I do not go first. My opponent always gets first turn. And I actually think there's some value to that in practice, because
if I go first,
bad things happen.
Yeah.
If I don't go first, I need to know
how
I survive turn one.
Yeah.
Because the army is as brittle as a box of peanut brittle. Like, you throw it and it'll explode.
Yeah.
And it'll also give me the opportunity to sort of see some of the other Alpha Strike armies that a drop pod army terrifies me at the moment. I'm not really sure how to deal with that.
Yeah.
So not going
point blank multi melters into Warp Hunters.
Exactly. So there's a lot to be learned for me by not going first.
Yeah.
So if we do play a bit in the next 8 weeks,
mm-hmm.
I will not be going first.
Okay.
So you can build the most dirty, horrible list you like out of the ITC format, and then you get to go first guaranteed.
Sweet. So instant arriving three Storm Ravens. Yeah, I'm loving it.
And watch you fail that 3+3 rollable and go, I just tabled myself. look, we'll leave it there though, guys. I hope you enjoyed the episode. You'll no doubt hear from Dan again in the near future. Thanks very much for coming, Dan. Hope you enjoyed yourself.
Absolutely.
Until next time, take care everyone and play more games. Enjoy yourself. Cheers. You've been listening to the Objective Secured podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, you can visit our website, objectivesecured.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/objectivesecured, or you can email us, obsec@optusnet.com.au. Thanks for listening.